Welcome to this Forthright Radio for April 19th, 2017. I'm Joy LaClaire. We have a very full show for you today in two segments focusing on upcoming environmental events, Earth Day, which is this Saturday, April 22nd, and the March for Science, which is a week of action from this Saturday to next, April 22nd to 29th. In the first half hour, our guest is Gretchen Goldman of the Union of Concerned Scientists. In the second half hour, our guest is Kathleen Rogers, president of Earth Day Network. Ordinarily, I don't organize Forthright Radio shows around declared months or days. For me, every month is African History Month or Poetry Month. Every day is International Women's Day or Earth Day. But this year is distinctly different from any I can remember. Our species, Homo sapiens, which is the Latin for wise man, is acting with disastrous lack of wisdom, and the biological and geological evidence of ongoing disaster is mounting as we speed willy-nilly into the Anthropocene. But even as the forces of greed and ignorance accelerate their efforts, wreaking environmental chaos and destruction, those who see this folly are rising and resisting to protect the biosphere. And one of them is our first guest today, Gretchen Goldman. Gretchen Goldman is the research director for the Center for Science and Democracy at the Union of Concerned Scientists. Dr. Goldman leads research efforts on the role of science in public policy, focusing on topics ranging from scientific integrity in government decision-making to political interference in science-based standards on hydraulic fracturing, climate change, sugar, and chemicals. Before joining the Union of Concerned Scientists, Dr. Goldman was at the Georgia Institute of Technology, where she was a postdoctoral research fellow working on statistic modeling of urban air pollution for use in epidemiologic studies of acute human health effects. She has authored pieces for Science, The New York Times, and The Guardian, and has been quoted in many other journals. She currently serves as the vice chair of the Air and Climate Public Advisory Committee for the Metropolitan Washington Council of Governments. Welcome to Forthright Radio, Dr. Gretchen Goldman.
Thanks so much for having me, Joy.
You certainly have your work cut out for you these days, I must say that.
It's definitely keeping me busy.
As I noted in my introduction, you've done epidemiologic studies on the health effects of urban air pollution. I wonder what your reaction is to the news, according to the Environmental Defense Fund, that just yesterday, the Trump administration filed a motion to postpone the oral argument on America's mercury and air toxic standards, which were scheduled to take place in the second highest court in America in mid-May.
I was really disappointed to see that. I've seen the science, I've looked at the data, and these are very science-based rules. The air toxics rule, the ozone rule that was recent are very strongly grounded in science. And the EPA has a very good process for putting that science into policy decisions. And I have been really disheartened to see that rule be delayed. It looks like the ozone rule might be delayed. And they're really looking to disregard the science in places where they're even legally obligated to. So that's one of the big reasons that I'm concerned about what's happening.
I grew up in the post-Sputnik era, and there was almost a reverence for science in the United States. But over the past couple of decades, it seems that this, forget about reverence, but just even respect for science has been seriously eroded. There are segments of the population who just don't believe science represents any form of truth. Have you encountered this? And if so, how do you deal with that?
We're definitely facing an uphill battle in a lot of these issues, particularly with this administration and this Congress. We're seeing several efforts being put forth that would really undermine the ability of our government to even use science. So the very process, not even talking about specific policies, they want to change the rules so that we aren't even using science in the same way that we would normally. And that affects everything, all kinds of environmental regulations, but also our food safety and drug safety, and then many other issues that we think about when we think about what keeps us healthy and safe. So we think about how to really articulate what those challenges are for people and how they're going to affect people across this country, because I think it's going to be different when they can, of course, disregard science at the federal level, and they are, but not going to be as easy to ignore it when it's affecting real people. You know, if we don't have clean air and clean water as a result of this disregarding of science, that's going to be noticed, and people are going to notice and react to that and be upset. So we're working to really articulate that and leverage that to hold our decision makers accountable.
My question was actually going a little bit farther back than the current administration. I had already perceived an erosion of confidence in science, a distrust of science as, well, I don't really get it myself because I respect science. I turn to science to help me evaluate how I proceed in my own life, how I vote, and that sort of thing. Can you respond to that assertion?
Sure. We also have thought about that. That's actually why we launched the Center for Science and Democracy, because we sort of started to see that eroding of how science is perceived publicly and how it's portrayed in communications and how that affects the decisions that our decision makers make. So we've been thinking about that a lot and thinking about ways to really combat that. I think there's a few strategies. There's lots of work to be done still on connecting with people and making clear how science is central to their lives in a variety of ways, and that it isn't just something that happens at universities. It's something that affects your daily life. And so we work a lot on that effort, and I'm particularly heartened now to see so many scientists really engaged. I think that that's going to go a long way in terms of changing the public's opinion, because we are seeing a lot more scientists come out and want to talk about the benefits of their science and be in the streets marching and really engaging with decision makers in ways that we haven't seen before.
Okay, so that brings us to the March for Science that's going to be happening this weekend. Tell us what you want us to know about that.
This is slated to be the largest demonstration of scientists that this country has ever seen. I'm very excited that this is happening, and if you told me a year ago that scientists would be in the street marching, I never would have believed you. So this is a really exciting moment in history, and I'm really looking forward to seeing it on Saturday. I'm going to be there with my husband and toddler son, and we're going to be marching, and I think it's the start of a new era where we'll see a lot more scientists engaged in the political process and really take a stand in a big unified way. And so the March for Science is happening April 22nd. It's happening in cities across the world. I will be in the Washington, D.C. marching, but they're happening all over, and you can find out about them online. And please show up, and I know there will be lots of great signs and great events. There's great speakers lined up at all of the satellite marches as well, and so it should be a great moment.
It's not without controversy, of course. There were calls for greater diversity, and there are those who say that one of the reasons that some people don't trust science is because they perceive it as being that scientists do their research for ideological reasons, and this will only further that concern. How do you respond to that? And also, what efforts are being made in terms of diversity?
Sure. So there's a few things that have happened. So part of it, I'll just say that I think, you know, some of the challenges are just the consequence of the fact that these are grassroots movements that developed organically. And so it's not necessarily very experienced people who are, have conceived of these ideas. And so it's one sort of challenge of it, but it's also a good sign because it means this is getting more attention of more people, and we're having movements and energy from a lot of people that aren't typically engaged. So that's a really good thing. I think part of that has been that it's been somewhat of a learning curve for many to think about how to frame this and how to effectively make sure that the March for Science and the broader movement for science is inclusive and accessible to diverse audiences. So on the diversity point, the March organizers have been working to address this in various ways, and I, from the Union of Concerned Scientists point of view, wrote a piece about this point, and I believe that the movement should be unapologetically inclusive and that we all have a role to play to support our fellow scientists and really work against the institutional barriers that have long restricted science to a privileged few people. And especially in this political era, I think we need to make sure that we're supporting our fellow scientists, especially those that have begun to feel unsafe because of current political developments. And so I'm looking to really make sure that when I march, it's for that point and to really advance diversity, inclusion, and equity goals. So on the scientists engaging around this, I would just say that scientists didn't make science political. It's the hand we were dealt, and this has happened, as we've pointed out, that science is being pulled into political conversations now. And so to me, it's a question of whether scientists want to have a seat at the table and be able to engage on these issues. And to me, there's no choice. Whether or not we want to step out of our labs, I think everything depends on it now. Our own success depends on it, and the ability of the broader public to benefit from science depends on it. So I think more and more we're seeing scientists be willing to step out of their labs and into the street and really get engaged on this. And so I'm hopeful that this march is the start to a higher level of engagement for scientists.
Now, you mentioned the website, March for Science, and if listeners go there, it shows a map of the world listing 517 satellite marches. And the greatest concentration is in the continental United States. Well, I shouldn't even say continental United States, because you can't even see Hawaii. It's covered with these march icons. And the illustrator chose to use the color red-orange for these icons. And the United States is obliterated with red-orange icons. It looks like just fire all over the country. So I suggest listeners, just to see it, go there. And you can then select country, state, location to find more particulars about each march. But back to the political, first I want you to clarify political versus nonpartisan. And then I want us to get into the fears that scientists are experiencing under this current administration. But first, please clarify about nonpartisan versus political.
Sure. I think that's an important distinction. So when we think about partisanship, we're thinking about supporting of candidates and being affiliated with parties, which science, of course, is not. It's very separate from that conversation. But what we mean by science being political is that it's not value-free in the sense that if we look at the history, we can see that who has access to science, what questions are asked, and how science is used has always had political dimensions. And as the scientific community, we need to own that and make sure that we're working against these this misuse of science from our past and move forward to make sure that we have a more inclusive movement that lifts up the voices of those who have felt excluded historically by and currently by the scientific community. So I think there's a lot we can do in that space. And to that point, actually, there was just recently, this past month, a study came out saying that scientists' public engagement does not hurt their career. They're not seen negatively for being politically active and engaged around outreach and advocacy. So this was a really important and timely study that recently came out, and that's been an important data point in proving this, because historically scientists have often feared that their professional credibility would be harmed by being politically engaged. So this is a good data point to counter that.
Under the current administration, what are some of the fears that you are hearing from scientists?
Scientists are concerned with what we're seeing happen to the scientific enterprise as a whole. So beyond science funding, which of course is part of the concern, it's also what this administration is doing to the role that science plays in decision making and the role that science plays in our broader society. So far we've already seen some data be deleted off of government websites that used to be there. One of the bigger examples was this data set from the U.S. Department of Agriculture, where it was a data set of inspection information about animal welfare. So animal welfare at zoos or in research facilities, there was a data set that was publicly available, and that's now been taken down. And so the public no longer has access to that. So we've seen some changes like that where there's actual scientific information that's been removed. And we've also just seen threats to the bigger process. So the other concern that I have personally, and I think many in the scientific community have, is around the administration's two-for-one executive order that President Trump issued, which says that federal agencies would have to remove two regulations for every one new regulation that they want to put in place. And of course, rules and regulations for the government are issued in response to a threat or risk and scientific evidence that that risk needs a policy to address it to keep people safe. And so if we now are in this situation where agencies can't make that science-based decision and instead have to remove rules just for the sake of removing them, this is a dangerous precedent. We're then having politicians make decisions about public health and safety when that should be driven by the science that happens within the government.
How about the early hours of the Trump administration, or even before, as I recall, he was inaugurated? Wasn't his team requesting personnel information about people who had gone to meetings dealing with climate and that sort of thing?
Yeah, that's correct. That was in the transition period. So before the inauguration, the transition team had asked the Department of Energy for names of people that were involved in some of their climate-related work at the agency. And so my organization spotted this and helped to make this a bigger story in the media and really get the word out that this was an inappropriate use of the administration's powers. Because I am concerned about things like that, where we set up a situation where there's a big chilling effect on scientists within the government who are working on different issues that the administration might not want more science being done on. So that was an early example, and I think we've since seen similar changes happen that likewise do send more of a chilling effect for federal scientists. We've seen Trump's proposed budget, which would be very drastic cuts to science across agencies, and we've seen some cancellation of a climate change conference that the Centers for Disease Control was going to put on, and so we're seeing some concerning developments there, and we're watching closely to see what else comes of it.
Yes, and I seem to have recalled that a meeting that had been scheduled to discuss implementation of the Paris climate agreements was canceled. Do you know anything about that?
I don't know about that one, actually. I'll look into it. But I know there is a lot of other aspects of things that have been canceled or postponed in various ways. Another example I do know about is from there was a climate change-related conference in Alaska that many EPA employees go to every year. And this year, the administration cut back extensively on which scientists were allowed to attend the meeting. So they really restricted who could go. And we've seen a lot less public communication around these issues. This has been in terms of who can talk to the media. There was briefly communication gag orders on federal scientists right out of the gate in the new administration. So we're definitely seeing some developments that are having a chilling effect on scientific communication from federal agencies.
We actually reported on that Alaskan conference. Two of the members who were not allowed to go were actually stationed in Anchorage. So the claims that it was to save travel money ring somewhat false. I'll just read the headline, and this is kind of short notice because it was just yesterday that the article ran from The Guardian. The headline is, Trump aides abruptly postpone meeting on whether to stay in Paris climate deal. Subheadline, unlikely coalition of fossil fuel firms, environmental groups, and Republicans are calling on President to stay despite his pledge to cancel agreement. So we'll be following up on that. Now, before we let you go, which we have to do all too soon, what is the relationship between the March for Science and the Earth Day Network?
The Earth Day Network is co-sponsoring the March for Science. They do this sort of march every year, but of course this year it also has the broader March for Science umbrella as well. And so there's a much bigger opportunity there in that we can combine what the Earth Day Network is doing and also the new March for Science and the new Movement for Science. So I think your next interview will be a great segue into talking more about that. And I hope to see everyone on Saturday marching.
One last question. What is the relationship between the March for Science and the People's Climate March, which is happening the Saturday after the March for Science on the 22nd? So the People's Climate March is April 29th.
I'll have my walking shoes on for the whole week. They're between the two marches. There's a week of action that's going to be around science and climate. And so we're looking to really make this a full week of action that's pinned by both marches on either end. And so I think it will be a great way for both marches to be successful and to really amplify that message around climate change, of course, being one of the key issues that many in the scientific community are concerned about and concerned about our lack of policy to address it. So I'm looking forward to both marches. They're separate, but I think they're very much related and will be a great way to combine the two causes.
Okay, any final words before we let you go?
Thank you so much for having me. I'd love to come on again, and I appreciate your taking the time to chat. You can follow me on Twitter at GretchenTG, and my organization, the Union of Concerned Scientists, does a lot of work with both scientists and citizens. So if you're looking to get further engaged, check us out at ucsusa.org.
Well, Gretchen Goldman, thank you so much for joining us today on Forthright Radio.
Great. Thank you so much, Joy.
Now on to our next guest. Kathleen Rogers, president of Earth Day Network, has worked for more than 20 years as an environmental attorney and advocate, focusing on international and domestic environmental public policy and law. Under her leadership, Earth Day Network has developed a significant role in advancing the new green economy and has emerged as a dynamic year-round policy and activist organization. Earth Day Network now reaches into 192 countries, and it's embracing new constituencies, including youngsters and people of color, and integrates civic participation into each of Earth Day Network's programs and activities. We welcome you to Forthright Radio, Kathleen Rogers.
Thank you for having me. Nice to be here. Well,
thank you so much for joining us today. Am I correct that you have been working with Earth Day Network since 2001?
Yes. In fact, I started at the very end of 2001.
Well, those were difficult times, and it doesn't seem like it's getting any easier. What can listeners expect from this year's Earth Day events?
Well, I think a number of things are all coming together at one time. There is the obvious concern that people have about what will happen to the 40-plus years of laws and regulations that have protected us and our kids from everything from pollution, asthma, lead, mercury, chromium. The list goes on and on and on. And many of those laws and regulations are being rolled back as we speak with great fanfare, I must say. And so this Earth Day becomes a little bit more complicated by not just the status of environmental laws and regulations, many of which I've worked on and really understand because we work with scientists, the scientific basis for, you know, why, for example, we don't put lead in gasoline or why mercury is bad for our children's fetal development and why it's important to promote alternative energies to reduce pollution and deal with climate change. So we have those issues that we're dealing with on Earth Day. Around the world, I think it's a very different place right now. There was a trajectory that we were on beginning in the last 3 to 5 years that I felt would lead us closer and closer towards a pivot point where we would begin to see the price for solar, wind come down, which we have, and that it would eventually replace oil and coal for sure, because many coal-fired power plants are either being mothballed or they're not being built. And so we have that trajectory I thought was firmly on its way. And we also had the climate agreement, which, as you know, opened for signature on Earth Day. And then on top of it, we have young scientists went online and said, let's do a march for science. And Earth Day Network decided to take it on in Washington, D.C., which is the sort of central event nationwide, although there are many organic events in the U.S., many of which are Earth Day / March for Science events. So we have these sort of four things coming together, the rollback of environmental laws and regulations, Earth Day, the year anniversary of the climate agreement, and the March for Science. So it's a busier time even than normal for us, but I think there's a lot of spirit and interest, not just in the U.S., but worldwide for promoting both the green economy and understanding the link between health and environment.
I think under your administration, correct me if I'm wrong, Earth Day Network has started a green schools campaign. What can you tell us about that?
Well, I think, as you know, I don't know if you have children, but certainly your listeners do, our kids spend sometimes 8 hours a day or longer, five, sometimes 5.5 days a week inside a school. And our Green Schools campaign has more or less five components. It started with environmental education, which we have been engaged in since the first Earth Day. And I can go back to that in a second, but we have literally 50 different state environmental literacy plans, most of which were created by volunteers. But the biggest component, in addition to environmental education, which is one of our main campaigns, is our concern about bricks and mortar. We know that the buildings that our kids go to school in, with lots of exceptions, but not enough, the vast majority of our schools need a huge amount of work in order to be fit for children to attend school in. And I'll give you an example. Los Angeles, we tested indoor air quality in a number of low-income schools in L.A. and found that it failed both California EPA standards and federal EPA standards and was putting the kids to sleep. We've tested water inside school buildings and found that it wasn't up to state or federal standards. We've worked and engaged in this area for many, many years, so we created a campaign around green schools, the intention of which is to promote financial vehicles that make sense for middle, low-income communities to refinance schools so that they can build green ones. We know that green schools promote better test scores. It reduces anxiety and tension in schools. It promotes optimism in children, and that is so important for low-income kids to feel optimistic about their future. We know that they grow taller, And my favorite, since I hate the dentist, and I'm sorry to all the dentists that are listening, it helps and reduces tooth decay. So there are dozens and dozens of benefits for children going to school in a green building. And so that's one of the main campaigns that we're working on. We're looking at financial vehicles, everything from low interest loans to creative ways to finance it with energy savings. But we're beginning to see a real interest in communities to create bond initiatives that will build green schools. And the incremental cost of doing that above a business as usual school is smaller and smaller each year. And so it's a lot smarter to build a green school and not pay for energy costs and to have healthier kids than it is to stick with an old building.
I know the headline, it's somewhat off what you were just talking about with the Green Schools campaign, but it does deal with schools. And the headline was this. This is from March 30th. Climate change deniers spam thousands of teachers with anti-global warming packages. And it talks about the Heartland Institute, a conservative think tank, that sent more than 25,000 science teachers across the United States a package of material it hopes they'll use in the classroom, which basically is talking about that the science isn't settled. I wonder if you have any comments on that.
Well, I think American teachers are a lot smarter than that. You know, it's, in my view, it's a tactic that we often see from people who want to remain in and their feet are firmly planted in the status quo. It is the interest of that think tank, although I don't think they're thinking, to maintain the status quo. They don't really believe that climate change isn't real, given 97-98% of all scientists, including almost every Nobel Prize winner, believes that human beings are causing climate change. We've been studying this since the 1970s, and even ExxonMobil knew about it in the 50s. So it's not something even ExxonMobil's denying. Climate change is real. Climate change is caused by humans. And more important, we can do something about it, and we can make a lot of money. There are more jobs in solar and wind and renewables than there are in oil and gas and coal combined. And that is a new fledgling business and a new industry. And of course, it needs a boost. Not unlike what happened in the Industrial Revolution, where governments and corporations and consumer groups all got together and said, hey, we need to promote a modern society. We need to move people to different types of products that will help our country develop. And that kind of enthusiasm by industrialists and the government then and consumers and faith-based groups, everybody back in the 1800s, really drove that general global acceptance and made America what it is. We must be nuts not to be taking this by the reins and running with it, because it allows us to build systems. It allows us to build products that we can export around the world. And so our interest is not just in promoting whether climate change is real, but to see how we can benefit from it worldwide and also find a solution to something that will hurt the United States and the rest of the world. So it makes no sense from a pollution point of view to promote fossil fuels, from an economic point of view, from a climate change point of view. And yet there are these so-called think tanks who want the status quo. Either they're funded by the oil and gas industry or because they're simply misguided. But in any event, what they're putting out there is plain old wrong, and I'll bet the teachers of America reject it.
Well, there's good news and bad news in the rest of this particular article. The bad news first. The National Council for Special Education published survey findings this month that 75% of public school educators devote time to teaching about climate change, but around 30% of the 1,500 teachers surveyed cast doubt on the cause, disputing scientific consensus about the phenomenon. So that's the bad news. The good news, in the same article, a Gallup poll published on March 14th found concern about global warming at a three-decade high, this is in the United States, with 71% of Americans saying they believe the phenomenon is occurring. So it's an evolving situation, and politics has a lot to do with it. So I am curious. I had not realized that Earth Day Network is a global phenomenon now in 192 countries. Please talk to us about that.
Yeah, and just to answer your question, I'd like to see the survey. I know the survey you're talking about, but really dig into it, because I don't believe for a minute that 3 out of 10 of our teachers don't believe in climate change. There are states, I'm not really sure why, West Virginia and a few in the far west, that have taken climate change out of their curricula, that have actually barred it from being taught. But again, in our experience, and we go to big conferences where we meet teachers from every single state, and these are not progressive or conservative people. These are teachers. And across the board, they're not just aware of climate change, but they're enthusiastic about teaching their kids about it so the kids can get the jobs of the future. And we work in all of our states. And truthfully, I think a much smaller percentage of teachers actually are climate deniers. They're just a smart group of people. But anyway, going to your next question, in about the year 2000, after Earth Day had been around, there was a giant effort. It was, I think, the 30th anniversary, yes, of Earth Day. And we started sort of working more intensely globally to kind of understand what Earth Day had become worldwide. And what we discovered, and I think by 2000 we had 176 countries that were engaged in Earth Day. And we've devoted more and more resources to building the environmental movement worldwide. And the answer, of course, is why would we do that when there's so many issues in the United States? Well, first of all, we truly believe that there is globalization, that climate change, for example, is a global issue. So what China builds or burns in its major cities on a Friday can reach L.A. by the next Tuesday. I mean, we can't contain pollution or anything else within our borders because we travel and because pollution travels along with it. And so we really needed to shore up the environmental community and work with them to educate people about the environmental movement. We opened 3 different offices in India, for example, an incredibly interesting country where 400 million people have no electricity. In other words, when the sun goes down, it's pitch black outside. And so even there is a tremendous interest in figuring out ways where they can be both energy efficient and have energy at all, but also become involved in the environmental movement, because they're living what the heartland of America lived and all our cities lived in the Industrial Revolution through the 50s and 60s, which is filthy rivers, bad water, dying species, and all of those sort of obvious things we cleaned up in the United States. But the rest of the world, I don't mean Europe, they're very highly developed, in fact, more developed than we are, or Canada, but lots of other places in the world really need to build a civically engaged community. Politicians like people who are engaged in the environmental movement. Even in countries where we have progressive governments, totalitarian governments, they like Earth Day. Why? Because they want people engaged in cleaning up their community, alerting them to pollution. And so we've had kind of global acceptance of Earth Day as sort of a people's day, a day when all of us can get engaged in everything from protesting to writing petitions to talking to their governments to doing cleanups, planting trees. And so depending on the community, there could be dozens of different activities going on. But for the most part, governments, corporations, everybody gets into the act.
I don't want to constantly be harping on the negative, but it's also not okay to be blind to the negative. We report over the years of the dire consequences of environmental activisms in countries around the world, where people who are trying to protect their local environment are murdered. So I'm curious, are there any dangers in any of the countries in which you attempt to have an impact?
Yeah, I mean, I can be honest, even a few years ago, but going back maybe 20 years ago when I worked on very tough issues in local communities where I would be going into a community, this is in the United States, where it wouldn't have been unusual for me to think about whether I might get hurt by the local people because they saw environmental regulation as ruining their lives, hurting their jobs, taking away their livelihoods. And all of those things are critically important values that the environmental community really has to focus on, because we don't want to put one person out of business. We want to create green jobs, and it's incumbent on us to do that. And so we've experienced that anger and frustration in communities where they might be building a power plant that's going to pollute everything downstream, and we activists came in and changed the plan around or made it less polluting or got rid of it altogether. And that makes people really unhappy because they need the jobs. And that is something that is sort of exponentially felt in the developing world. There are many parts of this world where there is no rule of law, no judicial oversight, no laws and regulations, or even if they have them, they're not enforced. I am a Goldman Prize nominator, and a few years ago we nominated a man who had been shot and his daughter, young daughter, had been murdered. He was trying to prevent a coal-fired power plant from being built in India, and he was desperately ill from the gunshot wounds and could not be treated. He came over here. We helped him get better, but he lost his child to some local coal mine operator who, while he and his daughter were sitting on a deck or a porch outside their house, he shot them. And so absolutely we're seeing this. In fact, this year was a terrible year for environmentalists, and dozens were either shot at or killed, or family members shot at or killed. And so it's not something that we aren't really aware of and need to protect those people, make sure that we can work not just on environmental regulations, but also on the rule of law, because you can have environmental books on the as many as you want, but if they're not enforced, they're useless. And so this happens in the developing world on a regular basis. I kind of separate that, from Earth Day itself, where people view as a day, a much more positive day, a day to get things done. But the daily lives of environmentalists in the developing world and around the world, frankly, are not always that easy. It's not like we all have to be heroes, but there are genuine heroes worldwide that put their lives on the line every day to protect their communities.
In Mendocino County, we saw similar struggles where protecting the environment was seen in conflict of jobs, and corporate powers always bring up the jobs issue, and it often puts down the protections of the environment. And of course, once the environment is destroyed, there go the jobs as well. But that brings up another project on Earth Day Network, Trees for the Earth, the Canopy Project. Talk about that, please.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I mean, I think most people understand the benefits of the trees, not just from a carbon perspective, but from a shade perspective in a world where you can get skin cancer or runoff or property values. A tree brings, or biodiversity values. Trees bring extraordinary riches to a community. Now, they also bring those riches in terms of paper and pulp and everything else. And we have a situation globally where we have deforested not just trees in the United States and Canada, in the Western Hemisphere, in the Northern Hemisphere, but in areas that are particularly important, not just for biodiversity purposes, but because the ecosystem that these dense forests are in create a much greater percentage of our CO2 protection, as well as our oxygen protection, et cetera, et cetera. The Amazon is, of course, the classic example, but there are forests in Indonesia, the Philippines, and other places that are being cut down, where they create microclimates and numbers of other environmental and weather values and financial values that it's very short-sighted to take them away. But then on top of that, we have climate change. And so in many, I think it's 51% of the country's commitments around climate change in the Paris Agreement, 50% of the countries, a little bit more, have reforestation or avoided deforestation as a central component of their climate commitment. So whatever country you're looking at in Central America or parts of Africa and Asia, reforestation is a part of the way they will reach their climate commitment. A lot of these countries don't have a big CO2 footprint, but they have allowed the U.S. and other countries to come in and clear-cut them for short-term gains. Now they're in trouble. So they're going to reforest. And that, of course, brings back biodiversity, brings back jobs, brings back clean water, brings back ecotourism. I mean, the values and connectivity around forests are just extraordinary, and people are really starting to recognize how essential reforestation is. So we created something called the Canopy Project. It started many, many years ago. Of course, we plant trees for Earth Day all the time, but we started looking at ecosystems and in countries that have been ravaged by everything from earthquakes, fires to you name it, as places where we wanted to encourage people to donate either through us or directly to the countries to reforest. Haiti is a perfect example where they cut down all the trees. I mean, all you have to do is look at Google Earth and you see the Dominican Republic and then you see Haiti. Haiti cut all the trees down. And then when they had a number of natural disasters, their houses were all built on the equivalent of sand and they fell down, creating incredible devastation. But, and they needed the wood for firewood, a very poor country. And so we started working there, and then we recognized that people really want to get engaged. Tree planting, whether you're donating or doing it yourself, is a really rewarding experience. And so we created a canopy project. We work with community groups worldwide, which helps build their capacity, gives them the ability to create their own infrastructure, raise money, create jobs, et cetera. So we created a sort of elaborate and it's really terrific plan to help reforest parts of the developing world and even parts of the U.S. So it's, again, tied to the climate agreement. It's also a way for community groups to make money and to save their communities. And we're planting everything from dense forests to fruit trees in parts of India, for example, where we're replacing fruit trees, which then creates a local economy. The trees aren't cut down. And so it creates jobs and food. And we are planting 7.8 billion trees by 2020, if we make it. And that is for one, for every human being who will be on Earth by 2020. We were told the other day by the UN it actually might come down a little to 7.6 billion people. So then I wouldn't have to plant 200 million additional, 200 or 300 additional millions of trees. But we're headed that way. We're at about 2 billion now.
Well, I hope you'll plant them whether the population goes up or down, either way, because we surely need it. And of course, not every tree that's planted survives. So doing too much is better than too little. Kathleen Rogers, we're just about out of time, but I want to give you the last 30 seconds for some final thoughts for our listeners.
I think if people are going to do one thing on Earth Day, it's call your state legislators, call your local electeds, and above all, call the President of the United States and call the Congress and tell them that you really don't want them to roll back 47 years of environmental protection. Our children's health, the health of the planet, is really at stake. Every year we don't take major steps towards climate change is now like a decade, and it's all rolling towards us. It can be an incredibly creative time. It can protect the Earth. It can create jobs and save our kids and our grandkids' future.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today on Forthright Radio, Kathleen Rogers.
Thank you for having me, and happy Earth Day.
Well, best of luck with all the things going on. We appreciate your being there.
Hi, my family's had enough of me, so I'm looking forward to Sunday.
Thank
I
bet.
You so much.
Our guests today on Forthright Radio have been, in the first segment, Gretchen Goldman, Research Director for the Center for Science and Democracy at the Union of Concerned Scientists. And just now we spoke with Kathleen Rogers, President of Earth Day Network. Forthright Radio is a Beyond the Deep End production broadcast each first and third Wednesday of the month from the Philo Studios of KZYX and Z, Mendocino County Public Broadcasting. Engineer Rich Culbertson, I'm Joy LeClaire. And you can contact us by emailing forthrightradio@gmail.com. Just a short comment. My understanding is that the original deforestation in Haiti was the result of the freeing of themselves from slavery from the French and Napoleon's placing on them, reimbursing the French for their own liberation. It took them until 20th century, from 1804 or whatever, till sometime in the mid-20th century to pay off that debt. And one of the ways they did that was cutting their forests.